Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is Georgia Tech roboticist, Dr. Anna Howard. Anna, welcome
Hi.
To the show. Welcome to the
Thank
show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited about this.
I'm excited, too, because the readers and listeners know that I am a robotics nutcase. And I grew up with robotic technology and reading Isaac Asimov and being crazy about science fiction and robots and all kinds of manifestations thereof. I just finished watching the TV series on Netflix called Lost in Space, where they redo robot technology. Yeah.
Yes.
And
okay.
We have
so
another incarnation of a robot. Yeah, it's a new version on Netflix, the Netflix original. And they have yet another manifestation of this time an alien robot, which is very interesting. So I'm really pleased to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
For the listeners, you are the school chair for interactive computing at Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech. You're also the Linda J. and Mark C. Smith endowed chair in bioengineering in the School of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the director of the Human Automation Systems Lab. You received your PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. Pretty cool.
Thanks. And I'm a roboticist at the end of the day.
Yes. Yes. So how did it all start? Tell me about how you got started and your love of robotics.
So mine was also science fiction. The books, it was the TV shows. So I was fascinated around middle school. I had always been into science fiction and science fantasy and superheroes. And so, you know, everything from Battlestar Galactica, for those of you who remember that. So these were like the classic Buck Rogers. And one show that I particularly really enjoyed was Bionic Woman. And I knew
Lindsay Wagner.
Yes, yes. In fact, I have an autographed picture of her.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Isn't that? I'm like, oh my gosh. See?
I was in love with her when I was young.
See? I mean, it was like you had this like very human person, but yeah. She was amazing because she was also bionics. And so it was this blend. And so I was fascinated. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to build a bionic woman. So that's how I knew that what I wanted to do was something with respect to robotics.
Cool. Did that result in you pursuing robotics at an early level, say in high school and college, or did that come later?
No. So, and of course, back then, robotics really wasn't the robotics of today. And so robotics then was more like manufacturing and things like that. I mean, We weren't even exploring Mars with the rovers at that point. And so my kind of love came out is, you know, I was a self-taught, self-practiced hacker, right? So I would do things like hack the remote control car and connect it to a modem, you know, when we had to use modems to actually dial out to try to kind of create my own little robot remote control car kind of thing, learning how to create my own intelligent agents in the computer, so games. And so I was trying to create this world that I wanted because it didn't exist. And in terms of the major, figured out that what I probably should do was engineering, because that seemed like it could give me the skills that I needed.
As your bachelor's degree?
Build. Yes, my bachelor's in engineering.
That's correct. Good choice.
Correct. Yeah, it taught me a lot. It really did. Like the systems engineering kind of concepts of putting things together.
Were the college robot wars in force at that point, the little tactical war robots, or did that come later?
No, that came much later. That was I remember the first BattleBot I went to, I was in grad school, right? That was like the first one that I was like, and they were like, oh, it wasn't even a show. It was like, you know, a bunch of people getting together. It was like, there's something called the BattleBot and it's up in the Bay Area. I was like, let's go. Right. And so we hauled our way. We saw this show with like, you know, people had basically put stuff together in their garages. I was in grad school by then.
Did you run into any resistance or did you have supportive professors? Sometimes professors have attitudes about what you should be doing or they say, you know, that there's no future in robotics. You should be studying for your electrical engineering PhD and You could think all depends on your thesis advisor and how that goes.
I know. So in undergrad, I ran into a really good faculty member who was a roboticist. I mean, his name was Wallovich. And so he was like a computer vision robotics person. He was a manipulator, though. And he took undergrads. And so, you know, I was like, oh, robotics, do you, you know, can I do some research? And he was like, sure. I mean, I saw him maybe once a year. I really worked with his grad student. But it was like, yeah, come into my lab. And, you know, I had a great mentor through that. In terms of a grad student mentor doing that. And then I started working for NASA after my freshman year.
I want to ask you about that. Was your vision at this point more conventional in terms of building planetary robots? We'll talk about NASA JPL in a sec. Or were you fixated on the idea of iRobot kind of, you know, 6 foot tall family service companion robots?
Yeah, so I think it was in between. It wasn't planetary robots. It wasn't manufacturing robots. But it wasn't necessarily, you know, I always liked Rosie and the Jetsons, but I really didn't see building that either. I just saw building robots that could help people. And so, you know, it didn't have to be human. It just had to be a robot that, I mean, arms was kind of the thing. Like, it had to have some type of arms and be able to grab things.
Did that take you into interest in prosthetics?
I was actually interested in manipulation. So early on, I was doing manipulation. Like, how do you grab objects in that time, the hospital environment?
Oh, yeah. I've seen demos of robot arms and hands where they pick up an egg to prove that it has tactile feedback and it can pick up an egg without crushing it by stupidity.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what, in fact, my thesis was on how do you pick up objects that deform when you grab them? So if you had a robot that could, so my focus was like hospital. So if you wanted a robot that comes and could like make up your bed, how do you pick up a pillow? Right. And then how do you then pick up a patient? And then how do you pick up like a surgical instrument?
Without killing them?
Yes. So that's what I was focused on. That was my thesis, was like trying to figure that out by learning.
Neat. So after you, was that your PhD thesis?
That was my PhD thesis. And I actually, while I was doing my PhD, I was still working at JPL NASA. Ah. And so there it was about, it was really focused on the intelligence. I still wasn't on like the hardware side of robotics. It was primarily on the software, looking at how do you get, you know, systems to think intelligently? How do you get them to, like survey the area and figure out where I should go in terms of localization. Of course, those weren't the words. Like now we like, yeah, localization and navigation. And those it wasn't. It was just like, I have a map and the map deforms. Where should I put my little rovers in terms of maximizing coverage? Like it was much more in those terms.
I forgot to ask you a question about your PhD thesis. So did you have to construct a mechanical arm to prove that your algorithms were technically correct, or was it all theoretical?
No, I was always a hardware practical person. Like if you couldn't make it run, it didn't exist. Even now, it's like if you can't run, it doesn't exist. So my little contraption, I even have pictures of it. So I had these two manipulator arms.
Oh, send me one. Send me one. I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay, I will do that. It's black and white. I can do that. Yeah, so it had like a force sensor because I needed to give some type of haptic feedback, right? This is back in the day. There was like a camera, stereo camera system that I had tried to figure out how do you do stereo cameras when you didn't have that, right? Because I knew I had to have multiple perspectives. So it looks, you look at it now, you're like, oh my gosh, that is so simple. But at the time, that was like state of the art. And like, I would try to run stuff and it was like, oh, I'm going to let this run Thursday night. So maybe it'll be done by Monday. But you know, that was the state of the art back then.
Did work at JPL kind of get you interested in planetary rovers?
JPL, I got interested in figuring out, and I call it science-driven robotics. I was more fascinated with how do I get scientists, their knowledge of their ability to explore and find life on other planets. How can I give my rovers to mimic that? So I was always looking at that interchange of knowledge.
Yeah, because if a scientist wants to dig up some soil and he wants to do some lab tests, you've got to tell him that that's possible or not possible, depending on whether the device can actually dig or not and manage the soil sample and get it into the right container and all that stuff, right?
Right, correct. All of that, all of that. And so that's what I was fascinated by.
Cool.
And worked on. And it also, for me, it fit into this aspect of helping people, right? It was still this aspect of I'm helping the scientists in terms of exploring and increasing their knowledge base, which of course at some point then helps society so we understand things. Mm-hmm. And you know. Yeah.
So then you left JPL at some point. Did you go right to Georgia Tech after that?
I did. So I stayed at JPL even past my thesis. I mean,
But congratulations, by the way, because of the chances of getting your PhD after you start full-time job, that's a huge challenge, I think.
It definitely took me like a year longer. I can point to how long I was like, yeah, I remember when I was done, I should have finished in 3.5 and it took me 4.5.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. I don't remember the exact number, but there's some number out there that says if you're working on your PhD and you take a full-time job, your chances of completing your PhD are something like 15% or some ungodly number like that. So congrats.
Yeah, the motivation is not there. I mean, it's like, why? But I think because I was at JPL, there were so many like really smart people that had PhDs. And so I think that was a little bit of incentive because it was like, hey, if I want to have like, you know, a really like continue in this and start owning my own projects, which I was being pushed into, it was like, oh, no, I definitely have to have a PhD because, you know, I need those credentials in order to run my own projects.
Yeah, that's your job ticket to do research. Yep.
Yeah. So I didn't leave JPL for years after, and then I came to tech. So I didn't leave JPL until 2005.
Did you start off right away, hit the ground running at Georgia Tech with projects that you had in mind, or did it take a while to sort of get them psyched up about what you wanted to do?
Well, so that's the thing about academia. You don't really have a lot of time to figure stuff out because we have something called tenure. And so, you know, your honeymoon period, you got maybe a year, maybe 2 years to kind of figure it out. But you don't have a lot of time to figure out what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And so when I started, I was focused still on science-driven robotics, even though I knew I wanted to get back into much more, you know, human-based or earth-based robotics. But, you know, science-driven robotics, I knew scientists, I knew how to do that process. And so when I first got to tech, you know, I was like, okay, we're going to write some NASA proposals. And, you know, my first year, we got our big NASA proposal, which was to send rovers to glacier environments to understand, to look at basically global warming, climate change, but grab data from ice shelves that were melting. So I was working with some scientists that were interested in modeling what was going on in terms of weather patterns and all this stuff. And they needed data.
That helps you get some papers published, I presume.
Oh, tons of papers.
Yeah.
Tons of papers.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very important in your environment.
It is. It is. And also about that time, that was when I started experimenting of what else did I want to do? Which is again this, which was more human based, again linking up like more to the bionics and that health aspect, and so started experimenting and exploring more of robots for the home and what does that look like.
Let's get to that in the second half of the show. I want to ask you some more about that, but right now we have to take a short break, folks. We'll be back in 60 seconds after a word from our wonderful sponsor. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm chatting with Dr. Anna Howard, a roboticist. Hi, this is John Marcellera with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Simple Contacts. If you wear contact lenses and find yourself dreading that annual appointment to renew your prescription, then you're going to love Simple Contacts. This new company makes an annoying process very simple. Simple Contacts lets you renew your expired contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from your phone or computer in minutes. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are, whenever you need it. You can take the Simple Contacts vision test online in 5 minutes. A real doctor reviews it, and renews your prescription. You save time, money, and save yourself a headache. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. All the hard work is done for you. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses, and their prices are unbeatable. The prescription is just $20. Compare that with an annual appointment, which can be up to $250 without insurance. They have some of the best prices on contacts, and shipping is free. Best of all, listeners here will get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Just go to simplecontacts.com/BGM or enter the code BGM at checkout. Note, by the way, that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and renew your contacts if your vision has not changed. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off by going to simplecontacts.com/BGM or just enter the code BGM at checkout. Give it a try. And thanks, Simple Contacts, for being our sponsor. We're back. I'm chatting with Dr. Anna Howard, roboticist at Georgia Tech. So before the break, you were getting ready to tell me about, what was it now? I forgot.
More human-based, health-based robotics.
Is that something you're engaging your students with now?
Yeah, now that's what we focus on. I would say 90% of what we're doing is on, and I won't just say health, but looking at humans, it also incorporates aspects of trust and bias and things like that, but much more of the robots of today that people can use today or at least in the next 5 years.
Tell me about trust and bias. Those are two hot buttons for me.
Oh, yeah. So, and this came out from our research. So one of the things that I focus on, my group focuses on, is how do you do therapy in the home, right? So we bring in robots primarily for children with special needs, and we have them work on their therapy objectives. And one of the things that came up was the fact that kids would, I would say compliant, but that's the whole thing. We want them to be compliant, right? We want them to engage in the exercise, which means we have to do things to enhance trust, you know, such as social interaction, and the robots are emotionally engaging. And it came about was, I wonder if adults would trust these robots, right? Like, would adults be compliant? So we started
teaching that. Does that translate into the mechanical size and sort of like ominous structure of the robot? I'm thinking about Mayfield Robotics' Curry robot, which is about 2 feet tall, rolls around on wheels, doesn't have arms, and looks very innocent and very incapable of hurting you.
Right. So that's intentional. And so that's what we wanted to do, is make sure that we weren't instilling this, you know, trust because of the form factor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we started with an experiment where we basically took a, I would call it a robot tin can on drum. So it was basically a kind of an ugly robot, you know, round, not cute, very mechanical, with arms. And what we wanted to do was see, do adults, would they follow the guidance of this robot, even when the robot made mistakes, or even if the robot was telling them to do something that just didn't seem reasonable? And what we found was that people will follow the guidance of the robot. They will be compliant with even a robot that's not cute and cuddly and emotionally interactive.
Is that because they want to be willing participants and they're sort of on board with it, as opposed to being psychologically manipulated?
No, I think it's because there's this deferral that technology is correct.
Oh.
Like, when your phone tells you something, you kind of say, okay, right? And robots are now fitting to that. And now you even have this enhancements because people also assume robots are smart. So like my agent, my Siri, you know, is smart.
Is there any anthropomorphism here where you don't really know how smart it is, but you perhaps tend to assume it's smarter than it really is?
Yes, because it has a form factor. It has a physical embodiment, right? And it's moving around. So therefore, it has to have some kind of intelligence. It's moving around without, you know, it's going from point A to point B. So this started us down this journey. And so we're pushing it on in aspects such as self-driving car, like everything you could think of that concerns us, self-driving cars, medical applications, places where we know that we can get in trouble if we don't do something about, you know, mitigating trust in some form or fashion. Drones, military, like all these things, we're trying to push this aspect of trust, which also leads to this thing of bias, because our systems make decisions, but they're making decisions, like even my robots, we learn from data. And if my data doesn't represent all the possible decisions that could be made, then not only is my robot providing me a very niche kind of decision, but me, because I'm trusting it, is going to take that as truth, right? And so now we get back into the cycle of, you know, this is not a good thing necessarily.
What are some of the medical applications that are good candidates and some that are bad? For example, I can imagine a robot helping you with physical therapy and making sure that you don't fall. On the other hand, if somebody tells me to stick my arm into a machine that's going to draw blood, I'm going to cringe. So,
yeah,
are there any thoughts about proper for the current technology, you know, proper applications like that?
Well, so that's the thing. I've been to the doctor before and had my blood drawn, and they've had to take multiple times getting my blood drawn, right? Mm-hmm. That's been
can't
a
hit the vein right.
Yeah. They can't hit the vein right, right? So that, that's happened like one out of every five times this happens to me. I would probably be like, yeah, I think maybe a robot could do a little bit better than this, because I don't like shots and this is like very uncomfortable. I'm very fearful now when I go like, and I tell her, please just get it right the first time. I do this whole reprimand thing before they even start. You know, if a robot could get it right, I would be like, yeah. Now, then the question is...
Yeah, but there's a problem. But there's a problem. When you have your blood drawn by a nurse, it's a woman who has a warm touch and feel, somebody you have confidence in, somebody who's smiling at you, somebody you can connect with. You're putting your arm into a machine, you wonder, you know, we were talking about your PhD thesis. Is the machine going to screw up? Is it going to crush my arm? Is it going to drop too much blood? Is it I'm going to have vein damage, you know?
Right. No. So that's the negative. But then what happens if this, it's a nurse robot, right? So it's a robot that has a personality that does smile at you. Maybe it's sort of like a Pepper robot. And, yeah, you know, it's very gentle and it says,
that's
hey,
trust issue. Yeah,
exactly. Right. And you're right. What happens if, you know, the engineer was like, yeah, we really didn't do it correctly. Right?
Yeah. Like, sorry, software glitch. Sorry.
Right. So these are the things. It's like the robots and people, there's this aspect of trust. And yet, you know, our robots aren't 100%. They're not 100%. I'm sorry. No technology is.
Going on to the next subject, in 2013, you founded Xi Robotics as a university spinoff. Was that a university-sponsored effort to spin off the technology commercially?
So the company licenses the technology from my lab. And so what happens was I was working on all these things with the robots and the algorithms and, again, children with special needs. Mm-hmm. And we developed a bunch of different tools and even like the adaptation of the algorithms that I had parents and clinicians basically saying, oh, can we take this home? And it's like, no, this is like research, right? I this is not commercial. You can't buy this. And in fact, if you could, okay, Georgia Tech can't sell it. And so that's why Xi Robotics basically started, was to license, to be able to commercialize and, you know, support the development and then sale of some of these tools.
Do you have a vision of products along the lines of Pepper and Curry, something we just haven't heard of yet?
No. So Xi Robotics is focused on the beginning, which is getting kids trained in STEM early on, based on whatever they're learning.
Perfect.
Yeah. So we're creating the fishermen and the fisherwomen of the future.
Cool. Well, I want to ask you some questions about the general philosophy of robotics, being an expert. I made a list of some robotic technologies that seem to be kind of orthogonal to each other. There's the Boston Dynamics Atlas that the military is interested in. There's family robots like Curry and commercial greeting robots like Pepper. There's There's artificial intelligences like Alexa that are right now in Siri are kind of, you know, immobile. There's advanced prosthetics. There's planetary spacecraft robots. And finally, there's manufacturing robot arms like we see in car factories. All of these are robots, but they're sort of distinct areas from each other. Is there anybody who's thinking about, or maybe you who's thinking about, pulling together key areas of these technologies in terms of essential components in technology and AI to build the, you know, Asimov iRobot kind of family companion like we saw in Robot and Me?
Yeah, so there's companies that, well, even, for example, Ross. So Ross, which you would consider is like an architecture. I would say a lot of these, all the ones you mentioned, I would say 70 to 80% of them probably have some type of Ross package. And so that's one way of kind of and if you have a common infrastructure, at least on the software side, that means if I come out with a new, you know, machine learning algorithm or computer vision algorithm, if I then create it as a ROS package, others can also contribute and use and improve on it. And so that's one thing that has been going on in the community for a while. Mm-hmm. And that's on the software side. And even there's a bunch of and in our community is, you know, creating open source data sets so that we can create robots that are better and can learn better. And so, you know, if I'm creating my own, you know, computer vision or LiDAR based data set for my robot platform and someone else's, well, is there any way that we can share? And so now there is a community. It's like, you know, we're more than willing and open to say, you know, here's a shared resource so that we have a bigger data set among all of us versus just, you know, your one data set and your one data set, and we have this limited learning process. So that's also going on in the robotics community, is the sharing of data sets in terms of the sensor input.
Is there an organization that in this community that focuses on the ethics of robots? Recently, the subject has come up of when a robot calls you on the phone, does it have to identify itself as a robot and say, hi, I'm a robot. Even though I sound like a human, I'm really a machine and I'm obligated to tell you that.
The closest is that, so IEEE, and there's also some other organizations, but IEEE I think is the one that most academics and also industry looks at. They have a committee now on like the ethical guidelines of mm-hmm. AI and autonomous systems. Mm-hmm. Now they don't have things that are specific to things like you should identify yourself. So it's not prescriptive at that level, at least not yet, but it's not, it's more of a, you should, these are the things you need to think about in terms of when you're developing a product. And it's not yet prescriptive. It may get there. I'm not sure.
Wanted to ask you about the mechanics of robots because, you know, there's this issue of mobility and strength and power and how often you have to plug yourself in and the energy usage of the arm components and balancing that. I always wonder about that. What are some of the challenges right now in the robotics industry in terms of mechanical movement and flexibility and energy usage? How does that all come together?
Yeah, so I think I would say the largest challenge is the ratio of, you know, size and motor and torque to payload. Mm-hmm. So for example, for me to be able to lift a person out of a bed or lift a small child even off of the floor, the size that I have to make is larger than what a human, like, you know, a 6-year-old could actually carry a little bit of, could carry a baby, right? I mean, you kind of watch over them like, oh, please don't drop. But they can. Physically, they can. Right? They might be a little bit clumsy, but they can. But if we created a robot that is the size of a 6-year-old currently, they could not carry a nice size infant. It'd have to be much bigger and much bulkier, and the arms in terms of, you know, in terms of the torques it could apply, which just require it to be in a much bigger body size.
But that I think is a limitation. You worry about a 200-pound robot handling a 14-pound infant.
Yes, right. So then you're like, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. Yeah. So that is a challenge. And there are some companies that are looking at that, like, how do we create, you know, better, more, not only more effective motors, but, you know, ones with higher torque and ones that are compliant and, you know, dot, 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 dot. So there are companies that are looking at that.
Is it a battery issue, battery power density in watts per cubic foot?
It's about some of it is about the energy requirement to do that equalization. Mm-hmm. Some of it is about, you know, how do I like to be able to lift something up that's heavier than my arm, for example. Right now, if you think about what we're using things like muscle, right? So it's not just our joints. It's also the things that are attaching between, which robots, the way that they're designed, you know, there's linkages, but they're not as supportive as you would think tendons are. And so there's a difference in how our body's structured and why you can have a six-year-old lift, say, an infant versus a robot. And it's just the materials are different.
Are there any robot technologies like those used in planetary rovers that are so expensive and so sophisticated that they appear to be beyond the realm of consumer robotics for years to come? I was just wondering that.
Well, I would. So take an example. You mentioned Atlas as an example. If you think about the cost of Atlas, it's beyond a commercial robot platform, right? That's not going to be the price of. But I conjecture that platform, it could go into the direction of being a much more cost-effective thing. And I don't see the reason why it can't. I mean, some of it is supply and demand and things like that, but everything that we're doing is driving it to that direction. So it's not anything
how
that's
just... How long do you think that'll take? That's everybody wants to know. This is how long I have an Atlas robot who can carry me up the stairs if I have a broken leg.
Right. You know, the default answer is always 20 years, right? I mean, that's always the default answer.
Yeah.
It's either 5 or 20. 5 basically means, you know, we have it. We're just trying to polish it up. And 20 is, I have no clue.
Okay. So, $1 million robots for the military. Somewhere in between. Say again?
I said it'll be in between. I would say, like, we've been saying things like, we're going to have robots. I mean, I've been saying that for like every 20 years. I've been saying 20 years, right? And now I'm like, you know what? It could actually be 20 years. Like, I think we're starting to really believe that it will be 20 years, even though we said 20 years, 20 years ago and 20 years before that. But everything's really starting to line up in terms of the computational power, in terms of even the demand of like people like wanting this, right? It's not just like, you know, the geeks like me that want it. It's like people are like, yeah, I can live with this. I can do this. This might be easier for my life. I mean, people I think are much more receptive worldwide, definitely. But even in the US, I think people are starting to get much more receptive.
Do you see a social issue coming up with the cost of these robots in that wealthy families will be able to afford them and it'll be robot companions teaching their kids STEM, but families with less means won't be able to afford them and be disadvantaged? Do you see a social problem coming?
I see a social problem. I don't necessarily see it different than what we have now, right? So school systems, we know. If you are of wealth, you can send your kids to private school, or you can live in a neighborhood where, you know, the median house value is $1 million and the schools, you know, are reflecting $1 million homes. We see that already. So that we're not going to solve that or make that any worse. What I do see there being a disconnect, perhaps, is not on the education level, but on the workforce level. That's where I see some of the social issues happening.
Oh, a workforce. Tell me about that. What are you thinking?
Well, and there's been a lot of discussion and no one really has an answer. But so one of the things is when robots, you know, they're coming. And they are going to take positions that typically people have now.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I understand.
Right. And so is something that's going to cause some.
Have you seen the robot
social...
coffee maker at Starbucks in San Francisco?
No, but this sounds interesting.
I'll send you a note on that. Yeah, there's a machine that costs like $25,000. It's a robot barista arm, and it has access to all the ingredients, and it will just, the robot arm will just, you know, go through the process, the step-by-step sequence of, you know, getting all the liquids together and pouring it into a cup, and then the robot arm will place it down on the counter and hand it to you.
So an example.
Yeah.
Right? There's an example.
Yeah, when I write about robots, I usually end the article with something like, how are your Xcode and your Eclipse and your NetBeans computing skills? Because if you were planning to get a job at McDonald's or Starbucks, you may be out of luck.
Right. No, it's going to be. And so that's the thing, that there's going to be jobs, but it's going to be like, yeah, it's going to be the person that can code up. Or if they're, you know, Starbucks is like, oh, we're going to come out with our new recipes. You know, who's going to put that into the system? Right. That you need that person. You always need a person to deal with the, you know, disgruntled customer. Right. I still think that's a human job. Right. So you will always need that. And that's going to be a specialty.
Yep. Well, some people argue that as people lose their unskilled labor jobs, there will be new jobs created by robotics, just as you said, customer relations specialists and other kinds of jobs that are created as a result of the technology.
Right. Because you can't argue with the robot, right? Yeah. So the robot gives you something like, I didn't order that. And yeah, you did order that, but a robot can't tell you.
Let me play back the voice recording for you. So there.
Right. You would lose your customer, right?
That's
you
right.
would lose your customer if you did that. Even though, like, as an engineer, I'm like, yeah, that's what you said.
Well, guess what? We're running out of time. We've just burned through 36 minutes. It's incredible. Have I forgotten to ask you anything that you wanted to talk about? Let's take a couple minutes if I have forgotten anything.
No, I mean, this was a great conversation.
All right. Excellent. I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a wonderful discussion. I'm probably going to be calling you in the future as a consultant if you ever have any time to respond to my emails, because I've learned so much from you in this show about the technology of robots, and it's really whet my appetite to learn more. So I hope the listeners enjoyed hearing this discussion and learned a lot from it, as I did.
Good. I enjoyed it.
So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
You can send at Zyrobotics is an easy one. That's my Twitter handle.
Say that again. I think it dropped out.
Oh, at Zyrobotics.
Oh, okay. Got it. Thank you, listeners, for coming by. I hope you enjoyed this grand tour of robotics with Dr. Howard. And thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Simple Contacts. And you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.